taking Shakespeare's evil woman and humanizing her.
I never thought of Lady Macbeth as evil. So one of the reasons to work on her was to sort of to humanize her. Because there is this thing where she is demonized, where she's possessed by demons, possessed by the witches, possessed by Hecate. And it's like, I don't think she really is. I think she's just a woman who's protecting her family. And I think when we protect our families, we're always demonized.
That's playwright Migdalia Cruz talking about her adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth for modern audiences. Then some have questioned how Shakespeare, a middle-class glover's son from a provincial town, could have written such erudite plays. Could he have had a secret source close to the crown?
You know, I stop short of saying, yes, this is the answer to the Shakespeare riddle, but I find it just incredibly compelling. And I lay it out for the reader and I say, see what you make of it. And you decide whether there's something there. But at the very least, there's a much greater connection to Shakespeare and Thomas North than has been previously realized by scholars.
That's Michael Blanding. He tells the fascinating story of an amateur scholar who's built a compelling and controversial case about the source for Shakespeare's work. The book is North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rianna. In Migdalia Cruz's Macbeth, the witches run the world. The Macbeths live out a dark cautionary tale of love, greed, and power, falling from glory into calamity as the witches spin their fate. Translating Shakespeare's language for a modern audience, New Yorkian playwright Migdalia Cruz rewrites Macbeth with all the passion of the Bronx. This translation of Macbeth was presented in 2018 as part of the Play on Shakespeare Project, an ambitious undertaking from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival that commissioned new translations of 39 Shakespeare plays. Migdalia Cruz is the author of 63 plays, operas, screenplays, and musicals, and 5 translations, of which she says Macbeth is one. The paperback of Cruz's translation of Macbeth is out from ACMRS Press. Migdalia Cruz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking with you about this project, the Play on Shakespeare Project, and your participation in it with the play Macbeth. You're the author of 63 plays, operas, screenplays, and musicals. You have an incredibly prodigious output, and also 5 translations, of which you say that Macbeth is one. Why do you call it a translation?
It's a translation because I moved it into modern English, or I tried my best to move it into modern English without harming the English that was there. So it was about sort of clarifying the language. And so it's a translation for the 21st century of English rather than the whatever his century was of English.
I think it was the 16th.
Back in the 1600s or 1500s, that English that they spoke is which is no longer spoken. I wanted to make the words more modern and more present for a new audience. And I think in that way, I felt empowered by bringing him into our present reality.
How familiar were you, first off, with Shakespeare in general, and then Macbeth in particular?
Well, I knew everything that we learned in school, right? I didn't feel like I was I wasn't a Shakespeare scholar, and I didn't particularly feel like I needed to revisit his work. But in doing so, what I found was I was sort of fascinated that he was so He was so good at coining phrases. He was so interesting in the way he spun his poetry. And I felt like I learned a lot from him about poetry and about the rhythms in my own work. Because what I write usually is poetic realism. So I have my own kind of poetry that I bring to my work. But when working with Shakespeare, I was like, well, I don't want to hurt anything that's working there. And, I think Macbeth is, for me, is my favorite play of his. And it's like, okay, it has a perfect plot. It has interesting psychological outcomes. That all of that seemed very modern to me and didn't need to be touched. So then it was like, how do I make the language understandable without someone reading a book about it, without someone having a lexicon or having to be a Shakespeare scholar or someone who doesn't necessarily understand all those kinds of Shakespearean terms and the way he created his sentences. His syntax is archaic as well, right? We don't make sentences like that anymore, especially when we're in spoken language. So I thought, well, how do I do this without, you know, messing it up? Which was a challenge, and it was fun for me. I really felt there were a couple of things I did to sort of protect myself from Macbeth and Shakespeare. I went to visit his grave in Scotland. I went to visit Macbeth's grave and Shakespeare's grave, and I thought, well, I'm going to say a little prayer and hope that they will feel like I'm doing a good job or a just job with the words and with the language. I really didn't want to harm it. That wasn't the purpose. It wasn't to add, you know, add language that seemed really out of place. I wanted to keep it in Scotland, but I also wanted it to be fluid in the mouths of modern actors, American actors, and actors of color. It's like, I don't want people having to look stuff up. I want them to be able to read the script the way they would any modern script, and say, oh, this is what they're doing psychologically, and therefore deepening the performances from the beginning. So it wasn't a play just that was about language and about how smart you were. It was a play that was about people and with the same dilemmas we have today. So that's what I did.
Well, there is so much that you said there that I'd like us to unpack. First, Macbeth is your favorite play? Why?
Of all his plays, I feel like it's the most, it relates the most to my own work. It's a play to me that is about mourning and about how the other is enraged by their inability to enter society. And so there are consequences to othering other people, to making them outside of society, that forces them in some ways to behave badly, to behave aggressively or violently in order to take what is theirs. And in Macbeth's case, you know, they didn't have children, so they couldn't inherit. They didn't have a legacy to leave. Their only legacy was for Macbeth, was his own skill as a soldier. So when he doesn't get this promotion to king, which he deserved, really, and in old Scotland, that was one of the ways kings were chosen, by their fighting prowess and their loyalty to the crown. It wasn't just automatically that you gave it to your child. So when Duncan decides to give it to his child, I think it leaves Macbeth stunned, because he's also had this prediction from the witches. And that's the other thing that I related to. I love how he used the supernatural in this play. And I also often use the supernatural in my own plays. So I think all those things, in particular, this idea of mourning, which I have in all of my plays that he has in this play. I think about Macbeth and Lady Macbeth losing a child and what that meant to them, losing their legacy. I think about what it meant to me to lose a child and have a miscarriage. What happens to a woman psychologically and to a family psychologically when they lose a child, and the kind of sadness that can spur on violent, sometimes violent, sometimes desperate acts. And for me, Shakespeare encompassed all of that. And then there's the delightful witches, which I felt that really ran the play and run this world. And in my translation, one might say this is the part that I did a little bit of adaptation, because I wanted to really use the witches to be the engine of the play, so that they were forming the play rather than just predicting what was going to happen. They were actually making things happen. And I wanted to empower them as and thinking about them as women of color or people who have been othered, sort of coming to the fore and saying, I'm going to change the shape of this world. I'm going to choose the next king. I'm going to see how I can fit into this scenario and make it shift for my purposes. So I played a lot with the witches, and I added some language for them. I gave them some intros to different scenes that are not in the original text. I also added songs for them because I wanted them to be musical, and I wanted them to be fun in an outrageous and scary and sexy way. So that's why I love Macbeth, because it gave me all of that stuff to play with and work with and for myself unpack and then repack in a way that I understood when I heard it.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with playwright Migdalia Cruz about her translation, as she calls it, of Shakespeare's Macbeth into modern English, without losing the poetry and eloquence of the bard. You said it was the perfect plot. Why is Macbeth the perfect plot?
Because it's clear. There's not a thousand kings from, you know, different lands coming in. There aren't different countries. There isn't a... The main thing is that someone is going to be king. And how that person becomes king can either be by inheritance or by war. So here you have this couple looking to raise their status in society. And their only option, it seems to them, at that point in their lives is, we have to get rid of the king so that we can ascend. And somehow get the sons to leave town too. So it felt so. So to me, it's very clear what happens in the play. You know, the witches tell. I mean, in fact, the witches tell you what's going to happen, and so it does. But what's beautiful about it is the language, is the poetry of it, is the how you can see the machinations, how you can see Macbeth's ambition grow. And in fact, outgrow Lady Macbeth's. And at some point she's like, whoa, you don't have to kill everybody. And he's like, I'm afraid I do. I'm afraid I can't stop now. And for me, that is the essence of the tragedy. It's like he's gone so far over the edge. He cannot pull himself back. He no longer controls his own fate. And for me, that's perfection, because in the end, he gets what he deserves. Also, he gets slaughtered by Macduff, whose family he had slaughtered. And there you have sort of the, you know, quintessential justice of revenge, but also the righteous death. And the idea that there's this expression in Spanish, lo que lo tuyo y lo tuyo, like what's yours is yours, that you can't push yourself to get things that aren't, you don't deserve. And I think the whole play is about that, how people are pushing themselves to get the things they don't deserve. The Macbeths are pushing it until they move to another level that they can no longer come back from. In fact, it drives Lady Macbeth to suicide and madness. Well, first madness and then suicide, of course. And for Macbeth, it just leads him to kill his best friend, try to kill his best friend's child. All of these things are unthinkable acts that he thinks of, because suddenly he's in this this desperate mode of action. So for me, maybe that was a weird word for me to use. For me, that is a perfect plot. It's sort of like it has all of these tragic elements happening. You know, Banquo and Macbeth are devoted friends, and suddenly they are not. Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are a devoted couple, and suddenly they are going in different directions. Even Scotland, you know, seems like perfectly fine to keep a king that is gentle and kind like Duncan. But when he's murdered, Scotland then gets torn apart. So there are all these relationships that are being severed. Macduff, who was such a loyal person to Duncan, but also he was loyal to Macbeth until he realizes that Macbeth must have been the murderer. He says, you know, you killed the head of the household or something, the head of the I forget the exact words he uses, but he's saying, you've killed everything that is good in our country is now dead. And for Macduff, he takes his country seriously. It's also a play about loyalty and justice.
And, you know, the thing that has always kept me from Macbeth, which now is easier in this version, in this translation, Migdalia Cruz, as you have created it, was what I felt was the kind of the evil woman trope, you know, which includes the witches and Lady Macbeth. Was that something that you had to struggle with as well?
Well, I never believed it. I never believed that Lady Macbeth was evil for wanting to get what she felt was owed her and her family. I think because she was not royalty, not at the top, she was not in line to have those things that others had, that she rightfully felt were hers. Her husband fought loyally. He killed many people for Duncan. He killed many people for Scotland. He won wars for them, and he was a loyal soldier. And then it becomes like, this is the thanks I get. Here I am, you know, here we are so devoted, and we have nothing else, nothing to show for it. We just have what we've always had, you know, our little castle and our lands, but we're not king and queen. So I never thought of Lady Macbeth as evil. So one of the reasons to work on her was to sort of to humanize her. Because there is this thing where she is demonized, where she's possessed by demons, it's possessed by the witches, possessed by Hecate. And it's like, I don't think she really is. I think she's just a woman who's protecting her family. And I think when we protect our families, we're always demonized, whereas men are heroes. So there was that. And then with the witches, I really felt that the witches would be more interesting if they ran the world than if they just predicted it and were old hags. And in fact, when we did the podcast, we used these amazing drag queens to be the witches. And every one of them, it was so interesting to see that a duality of masculine and feminine in the witches and how that would land in frightening Macbeth and Banquo, because they actually say, you know, who are these creatures before us who sound like women but appear like men? And they talk about a kind of a sexual duality that they find kind of frightening or affronting. And the witches were delightful, I got to say. I loved having drag queen witches, because in a way they were so so present in their bodies, in their voices. And because it was a podcast, it was oral with an A-U-R-A-L, and they conveyed this kind of mystical presence, this magic that I could see being frightening to the average straight man. Right? It's like, why am I attracted to them? Because they are fabulous, and how can you not be attracted to them? But it's also that they encompass everything in the world. And then also because they're all people of color, thinking about, you know, people who are in power are generally not people of color, being confronted by a world that is being run by people of color. I think that whole idea that we've seen so sharply in this past year with all of our social justice fights that continue, you know, these battles for civil rights that we thought we won in the 60s, they keep coming back. So what happens when you make the other people of color? What happens when you put those things in this world that is ancient and yet futuristic, and try to sort of blend them to create, you know, whatever this new world is that is yet to come? That's how I felt. And I didn't feel that the witches were evil at all, ever. I just felt that they were very powerful. And again, I think when women are very powerful, they're considered frightening or threatening, or I don't know, somehow lesser than a man in that same position. So I never demonized either of the witches or Lady Macbeth. What I wanted to do was really humanize them as I saw them, as human.
Right. Well, I always loved the witches, and I was a Shakespeare aficionado from the age of 13. I mean, I used to memorize the plays, wow. But I never liked Lady Macbeth, and this is a whole new take on her. Now, I want to ask you about the podcast. Is this still available?
Yes. It's you can get it through Next Chapter Podcast. I think it's .com. Or playonpodcasts.com, and you can still subscribe to it. Now they have the whole series running all together. So it's because it was 7 episodes, My Macbeth, and following it is a podcast of Pericles, a translation by Ellen McLaughlin, and that follows mine. So that one is still being episodically done, but mine is done as a whole now. So it's available, and it's actually I love it. The music is fantastic. The composer was a man I know named David Molina, who, he did a wonderful job of like evoking both a modern Scottish sound along with sort of ancient instruments and instruments that were sort of sounded like found objects or, you know, steampunk kind of music. But it was, you have to listen to it. It's, for me, it was really evocative and beautiful. So I was very happy with what he did.
Well, we will link to that for our listeners as well. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Migdalia Cruz about her translation into modern English of Shakespeare's play Macbeth. It's part of the Play on Shakespeare project, which is doing modern verse translations of 39 of Shakespeare's. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work in general. You also have some other reimaginings among your work, like, for example, Another Part of the House, which is a reimagining of Federico Garcia Lorca's La Casa de Bernarda Alba. Talk a little bit about, you know, how you approach these reimaginings. How do you do that blend, which is the art of translation in a way, classic plays?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've been, you know, working with such masters like Lorca and Shakespeare. A part of it, I had to enter with a lot of humility and also bravery. So for me, it was part of it was prayer. Like when I was working with Lorca, with Garcia Lorca, I had a little altar for Garcia Lorca in my study. When I was working on Macbeth, I actually went to his grave. So there was, I do these pilgrimages, whether it's in my head or in actuality, or literally, I feel like I need to visit those writers and meet them first in their imaginings or my imaginings of them. So for instance, with Lorca, there was a prayer I always said every time I started to write with him. And I also had read somewhere that when he was working on La Casa de Benalalba, he listened to Bach. So I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to listen to Bach while I'm writing another part of the house. And the reason I felt for that particular adaptation, I should call it, or reimagining, in that case, I really wanted to rewrite it from the beginning. Like, can I close my eyes and imagine this play? And without reading any of the words, can I rewrite it? What happens when I rewrite it? And what are the things that I can write that he couldn't write in 1930s fascist Spain? And I thought a lot about all of his, about his homosexuality and about how he was never really allowed to write about it without, you know, fear of death. And in fact, he was killed because he was homosexual.
Really? That I didn't know.
Yeah. He was bayoneted in his rectum. That's how he was murdered. Horrible, horrible death. And so clearly someone didn't like who he was or who he truly was. And I thought, so if I'm going to look at his plays, I really want to look at it at this with this kind of queer lens. And is there a way to draw out the sexuality from the piece that he couldn't be obvious about? So I did make two of the sisters. I actually let two of the six sisters fall in love with each other, Magdalena and Amelia. And I also gave a heightened sexuality to Maria Josefa, the grandmother. And I actually paired Adela, the youngest daughter, and Maria Josefa in their sort of sexuality. They were both in love with Pepe Il Romano and sort of shared that throughout my play. So it was about women really talking frankly about their sexuality in a way that I don't think Lorca ever could have. So so I felt like I added that to the journey of his play. And so I felt good about that. Therefore, I felt good about, you know, messing with someone else's work. It's not an easy thing to sort of just go in and say, oh, I think I'm going to rewrite this. I can do it better. That's not how I felt at all. I just felt like maybe I could do it differently. And maybe there's something else to say about these characters that, you know, me in the 21st century can bring out because of who I am and where I'm from. I'm from the South Bronx, and the way I approach all of my work, which is to find the poetry in all of my characters that they might not otherwise be entitled to. So finding my way through these other plays, I just thought it was fun too, as scary as it was sometimes, just emotionally for me. I also felt like I had a reason to do it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't capricious or something on my part, or arrogant. I don't think I ever approached any of my work that way. I really wanted to do it to do service to the plays.
And say more about the poetry, because you mentioned that before. You love the poetry of Shakespeare, the poetry of your characters. You just said you write your plays with did you say realistic poetry? I wasn't sure.
I write in a style that I call poetic realism. I don't even know if that's a real style.
Yeah. So say more. What is poetic realism? What do you mean by the poetry? You're not just talking about rhyme or iambic pentameter. You're talking about something deeper.
Yeah, I think I'm talking about people finding their own way through and creating their own languages in telling their own story. So it's not about it's like a allowing that. I think often poetry is seen as something that is for the elite. It's something you have to learn in school. And I truly believe that poetry is something we all have in our souls, but we just need to allow it to be released. And by poetry for me and in my work, I think, I mean, to find a way to reveal the truth of your soul in words. And that may or may not rhyme. I mean, sometimes I do mean if I'm writing a musical, maybe it'll rhyme, but in my general writing, I'm trying to find a voice for my characters that comes from their viscera and also their hearts, that isn't an intellectual voice, that isn't something that I've just thought up out of the top of my head. It's something that I hope is welling up from inside me, that is also something that wells up from inside them and finds a way through that to the page.
That's so beautiful. And in fact, that is what poetry has always seemed to me. It is the evocation of the spirit and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So true what you say. Migdalia Cruz, it's just been so delightful, really, to talk with you about your, you know, what you say is a translation into modern English of Shakespeare's Macbeth and a reimagining of it as well, I would say. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was delightful.
Migdalia Cruz, playwright and now translator into modern English of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the Play On podcast of Macbeth. And here's a clip from that podcast with the opening segment featuring the three witches.
Now the storm outside comes in. Scotland's sun's rising as it sets. What one gives is what one gets. When
will we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won.
Before the setting of the sun.
Where's the place?
Upon the heath.
There to meet with Macbeth.
Aye, come, Greymark.
Pedacles.
Soon then.
Fair is foul, and foul is fair. Hover through the fog and filthy air.
That was the opening to the Play On podcast version of Macbeth, written by Migdalia Cruz. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Controversies over whether Shakespeare really wrote the plays attributed to him have arisen literally over the centuries. That's because many have questioned how this Glover's son from the backwater of Stratford-on-Avon could have written plays with so much knowledge of court politics, foreign lands, and international intrigue. Alternate authors like the Earl of Oxford have been passionately put forward and just as passionately rebuffed. But what if Shakespeare's authorship is real, but the source for his plays lies with someone who was in a position to have the erudite knowledge evidenced in Shakespeare's work? Another playwright whose plays Shakespeare reworked in his own genius of language. That's the thesis of Michael Blanding's new book about the renegade scholar proposing that theory. Blanding employs all his skills as an investigative reporter to put the evidence before the reader. He also takes readers inside the vibrant era of Elizabethan England, as well as the contemporary scene of Shakespeare scholars and obsessives. Michael Blanding is an investigative journalist and best-selling author of The Map Thief. North by Shakespeare is the winner of the 2021 International Book Award in Narrative Nonfiction. Well, Michael Blanding, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me on.
North by Shakespeare, a little bit of a pun in that title. The subtitle is A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. So this is a book that is a lot more than just about what was the source for Shakespeare's plays. It's a wonderful exploration of Elizabethan and in Tudor times, in fact, starting with Henry VIII, and also a discussion of kind of how knowledge is created as you write and what it takes to change established thinking. Tell us how you got into this story about Shakespeare. You know, basically the thesis is that he rewrote the plays of someone called Thomas North. Tell us how you first got into the story.
That's right. Yeah, the title is a pun on North by Northwest, which of course is a line from Hamlet, but it also refers to this idea that Shakespeare may have rewritten these plays by Thomas North, hence North by Shakespeare. And this theory has been put out there by this really fascinating character and scholar who I met about 6 years ago by the name of Dennis McCarthy. And throughout the book, I kind of weave together his story about how he sort of arrived at this kind of bold claim. And also, I take you back into Elizabethan times and explore it myself to see if, in fact, it might be true. And I first came across the story when Dennis approached me after a reading that I gave for my previous book, The Map Thief. And Dennis had also written a book about maps and biogeography. And he approached me after my talk and we started chatting and we hit it off. And eventually we went out for drinks at this sort of small college pub on a Tuesday night. And about two or three drinks in, he leans across the table and he says that he's been working on this new theory about Shakespeare for the last 10 years. from his dining room table in New Hampshire. He's a totally self-taught scholar. He's a college dropout, and he sort of stumbled upon this these clues and this evidence that Shakespeare perhaps wasn't so original in his writings, and was actually using the work of this previous writer, Thomas North. And at first, I really didn't put much stock in it. I sort of thought that it was a crazy idea, and I didn't think it would go anywhere. But as he started showing me more and more evidence, and eventually we started traveling together across England and Italy and exploring this idea, and I became more and more intrigued by it, and it ended up in this book.
Now, there are a lot of people who doubt that Shakespeare even wrote his plays, and there are, of course, many more scholars who say that that's a totally ridiculous idea.
Right.
So talk about why those doubts have been even able to proliferate so easily in the first place.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to see how this persistent idea that Shakespeare didn't write his plays has sort of resonated for over 100 years now. And it's just this kind of theory out there that refuses to die, that people sort of come up with more and more theories and explanations over the years, whether it was the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays, or Sir Francis Bacon wrote the plays, or maybe Queen Elizabeth or another writer actually wrote the plays, and Shakespeare put his name on it. It was sort of this front person. And what I find intriguing about Dennis's theory is that it answers a lot of questions about how Shakespeare could have written about things that he would have had no experience in, like traveling in Italy or fighting in wars or things like that. But it doesn't rely upon some kind of conspiracy of personages who are all kind of, you know, writing these plays behind the scenes and then just using Shakespeare as a front man. Dennis believes that Shakespeare actually wrote all the plays that were attributed to him during his lifetime, but that he was using these earlier source plays by Thomas North. And it was actually a common practice in Elizabethan times to use previous plays and to rewrite them and put your name on it. And, you know, it wasn't looked down upon the way it would be today. And so it's a neat theory that really answers a lot of questions while at the same time, you know, being within the kind of bounds of reality of how plays were written at the time.
And you go into how, you know, this whole development of Shakespearean drama, which was such a break with the past, just give us a little kind of mini history lesson about how playwriting was done and why did it come about the way it is? You know, what was the break with the past?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because we look upon the works of Shakespeare today as these kind of monumental achievements, you know, the sort of height of English literature for all time. And back in those times, you know, playwriting really wasn't looked upon as a high art. It was, you know, something to entertain the lords at court or to please, you know, the masses in the theater, but it was a real sort of ephemeral art form compared to other types of writing that was, you know, seen as more substantial. And there was a real shift that started to occur at the Inns of Court about halfway through the 16th century, and where these kind of sons of prominent lords were kind of putting on entertainments for each other and you know, the Christmas revels and things like that. And out of that, gradually over the course of the next 50 years, what we know as the golden age of theater really emerged. And Thomas North was right at the center of that. He was actually a student at the Inns of Court, and he was actually master of revels for a time there. And so he would have been right at the beginning of this kind of seismic shift in theater and drama that really would bear fruit later in Shakespeare's time, you know, 50 years later, and really become the kind of monumental works of literature we know today.
So I guess at this point, you should tell us more about Thomas North. And by the way, yes, he was the master of revels for a while, but he also got basically sued or you know, relieved of his command, right? Because they said he never showed up.
Right. That's true. Yeah. Thomas North is a fascinating character. He is best known today as a translator, and particularly for translating a book called Plutarch's Lives, which is a collection of Greek and Roman biographies by the Greek writer Plutarch. And this book is really known as the source for Shakespeare's Roman plays. There's whole passages of Antony and Cleopatra and Julius Caesar that come almost directly from Plutarch's lives, with just a little bit of rewriting and a little bit of, you know, poetry thrown in. But, you know, it's essentially the works that North wrote. But he also just lived this really fascinating, colorful life where he was a diplomat to Italy and France. He fought in wars in Ireland and the Netherlands. And as I said, he was trained as a lawyer and was really kind of privy to the inside intrigues of court and the different factions that were going on there. So even in that kind of brief biography, you see all the kind of elements required for Shakespeare's plays of, you know, this obsession with Italy, this obsession with courtly life and the you know, various kings and queens and lords of the time. And, you know, of course, these, you know, dramatic scenes of war and Henry V and other plays. So he was really kind of, you know, I kind of call him the Forrest Gump of the 16th century. He was sort of always at the right place at the right time to witness these amazing events.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Michael Blanding about his new book, North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. Michael Blanding, your work delves into a lot of the history of the time, including the vicissitudes of religious conflict. This impacted the North family directly, beginning with North's father. You know, so talk a little bit about this family. And what was so interesting to me was how the North family survived these vicissitudes. You know, there was Henry VIII and the Reformation in England, and then there was the restoration of Catholicism, and then there was the restoration of Protestantism, you know, with Queen Elizabeth. So run over some of that for us.
Yeah, this was really fascinating for me to learn about. I mean, we sort of vaguely know about Henry VIII, and or at least I did, you know, his break with the church and all of that. But I don't think I really understood quite what a tempestuous time it was and how dangerous it was for the people who lived through it, that there were these, you know, changing swings, you know, radical swings from Protestantism to Catholicism. And if you were on the wrong side at the wrong time, you could literally be executed. And Thomas North's father, Edward North, was sort of this master of riding these political winds. And he always seemed to kind of switch allegiances right before the right moment and just prospered in this really, as I say, dangerous and difficult time. And there's actually some evidence that Thomas North, his son, may have kind of used some of these kind of religious factions and swings and power and kind of put it into some of these plays that would later be rewritten by Shakespeare. For example, Thomas's father sent him on this delegation to Rome in 1555 that was organized by Mary, Henry VIII's daughter, who was trying to restore Catholicism. And Thomas North actually traveled through Italy to Rome in this delegation that was supposed to go to the Pope. And along the way, he witnessed these just amazing sights and artwork. And Dennis McCarthy, the scholar I profile, believes that all of these elements were kind of worked into the play that would become The Winter's Tale, and that play is actually sort of an allegory for this restoration of the church and under Queen Mary and works in many of the details of that trip that Thomas took. And so you can really see how this kind of tempestuous political time may have actually inspired and worked into some of these works of literature in really fascinating ways.
Now, you really did catch me up short, because you said, you just declared, rewritten by Shakespeare. And I have to confess, I mean, I'm not convinced, and I'm not even sure you're convinced. Although now I'm wondering if you are, that McCarthy is true, because you say in the book that nothing disproves that North wrote the source plays.
Mm-hmm.
Neither does anything actually prove it.
Yeah, I try to maintain an open mind throughout the book, and I try to maintain my skepticism sort of on behalf of the reader. You know, I'm trained as an investigative reporter, and I don't take anything as true without really hard and fast evidence. What I do say in the book, however, is that if this is not true, there are just so many coincidences that Dennis has discovered in the plays, in the language, in some of the allusions to certain personages that would have been associated with Thomas More's life, or certain details that kind of come from his life or from his works that end up showing up over and over again in the plays for this kind of 50-year history. And, you know, I stop short of saying, yes, this is the answer to the Shakespeare riddle, but I find it just incredibly compelling. And I lay it out for the reader and I say, you know, see what you make of it, and you decide whether there's something there. But at the very least, there's a much greater connection to Shakespeare and Thomas North than has been previously realized by scholars. And it goes much further than just him using Plutarch's Lives as a source for the Roman plays. That I can say with certainty.
So tell us how McCarthy developed this theory. You know, he used plagiarism software. How did that work?
So initially, he started finding all of these references in these works written at the time that seemed to refer to Thomas North in coded ways. They would, you know, make a pun on the word North, for example, and then they would mention a Shakespearean play. And so he first started to just kind of see all these connections between North and Shakespeare that came up over and over again in these works from the time. But about 5 years into his explorations, he discovered this new technique of using plagiarism software. And it's the same kind of open source software that a professor would use to see if a student cheated on a term paper, for example. Except he took that computer techniques and he applied it to Shakespeare's plays and Thomas North's writings. And he essentially took all of Thomas North's writings, published and unpublished, on one side, and all of Shakespeare's plays on the other side. And he started coming up with just hundreds and hundreds of passages that were in common. And it wasn't just kind of an isolated phrase here or there. It was phrases that were, you know, 3, 4, 5, up to 8 words long. And oftentimes they were repeated next to other phrases in passages that sort of express a similar idea to something in one of Shakespeare's plays. And so we've long known that Shakespeare used Plutarch's Lives for his Roman plays, but this was all of Thomas North's writings and all of Shakespeare's works. And he just started finding these hits over and over again that seemed to imply that there was a much greater connection between Shakespeare and North than had been previously known about.
Well, the answer to that from some of the scholars in the book was to say that all it proves is that Shakespeare read North.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you say that he actually rewrote him? Because I can imagine, I mean, we have lots of, you know, you live in a certain time, people use a certain lingo, and,
sure.
You know, it. I mean, has there been, you know, the same kind of study of, say, contemporary authors to each other? You know, in other words, why couldn't this be the coincidence of you know, living in a, well, they didn't live exactly at the same time, but they lived within decades of each other.
Yeah, I think there's a couple answers to that. One is what I mentioned before, that it's not just these kind of isolated phrases, but they're whole passages that seem to express similar ideas to the plays and imply much more than just sort of a coincidental borrowing or something that's sort of, you know, in the water, so to speak, in the language. And in some cases, there are passages in the plays that are written before North actually even published his works. I'll give you one example. In Richard II, there's this whole passage about grief and about how grief is like seeing things through water and everything is sort of distorted. And it uses this very rare phrase at the time to dissolve the bands of this life. And Dennis was able to look at a database of English literature and found that, you know, only maybe 2 or 3 other people had ever used that exact phrase to dissolve the bands of this life. And none of them had used it in a passage in which they were talking about grief, seeing things through water. And this this whole passage is in Shakespeare's Richard II, but it's also in this book by Thomas North called Nepo's Lives, where there's a similar passage that's also talking about grief being like looking things through water. And it also uses that exact same phrase to dissolve the bands of this life. And it was actually published 5 years after Shakespeare's Richard II appeared. So now you'd have to argue that Shakespeare somehow had access to the private papers of Thomas North and was, you know, writing this before North actually published it, which is possible. But it seems like the more you kind of see these kind of, you know, quote unquote coincidences or examples, the more Dennis's belief that actually Thomas North was writing these early plays that Shakespeare was adapting becomes more compelling.
But then how did Shakespeare see it before? He must have seen it, according to your theory, he must have seen it before he wrote Richard II. So what's the relationship, the personal relationship between North and Shakespeare?
So Dennis's idea is that North was actually writing these plays himself. And you know, the other evidence and the other reason why it seems unlikely, in Dennis's mind at least, that Shakespeare was just sort of using Thomas North's works, is that there are all of these elements in Thomas North's life that also figure into the plays that are not in his writings. And, you know, for example, I talked about that trip that Thomas North took to Italy. Well, on that trip, he visited this Italian church where he saw these lifelike wax statues. And then on the same day, he went to this palace in Italy that was filled with artwork by this artist by the name of Giulio Romano, who's this sort of acclaimed Italian artist, but he wasn't very well known in England at the time. Now, in the climax of The Winter's Tale, there is this character who was thought dead, who they open up this chapel, and she appears as this lifelike statue. And one of the characters comments that the statue was made by the artist Giulio Romano. And then the statue sort of comes alive, and that's the, you know, dramatic climax of the play. Well, Thomas North writes about visiting these places in his journal, but he doesn't actually write about any of those details. He doesn't talk about Giulio Romano by name, and he doesn't talk about, you know, the artworks specifically. And so, you know, you'd have to argue now that Shakespeare not only used Thomas North's journal, but also somehow, you know, knew about these places from another source. And there's been no scholarship that actually identifies how Shakespeare could have known about these things. And that's just one example of these kind of uncanny similarities between Thomas North's life and the plays that lend credence to Dennis's theory that actually, no, he wasn't just using the works, but that Thomas North was writing early versions of the plays that somehow sold them to or gave them to Shakespeare late in his life, and that Shakespeare was rewriting them into the masterpieces we know.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Michael Blanding about his new book, North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. Michael Blanding, your work delves into a lot of the history of the time, including the vicissitudes of religious conflict. This impacted the North family directly. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I became a Shakespeare aficionado when I was... The language is so extraordinary. You know, it's really brilliant. And are you trying to say that this language is not Shakespeare's, it's Thomas North's? Because I'm really not understanding what role Shakespeare really is playing in this theory.
Yeah, well, this is what's really interesting about the theory, is that it actually still allows for Shakespeare's brilliance and Shakespeare's genius as a adapter of the plays rather than an original author. And so it doesn't necessarily get rid of Shakespeare the way that some of these other theories might want to do and say, oh, it was really the Earl of Oxford who was the genius and Shakespeare just put his name on it. In fact, Dennis has gotten the support of one scholar, a woman by the name of June Schluter, who is a professor of Shakespearean studies and was a former editor of a Shakespeare journal. And, you know, she's quite comfortable saying that Shakespeare used these early plays by Thomas North, but really changed them and adapted them and made them into the masterpieces that we know today. It's sort of like an analogy of, maybe like a screenwriter and a great director or something that, you know, you may have the script from a screenwriter, but it really takes a great director to bring that alive and adapt it for and make it into an Oscar-winning film. And that is the part that Shakespeare may have played in this theory, that he may have sort of taken these older plays by Thomas North that were written, you know, decades earlier for court and really adapted them for the public theater and made them into these thrilling masterpieces that we know today.
And so finally, how has been the reception to McCarthy, A, and to your book, B, from the Shakespeare community?
Well, let me say that outside of the Shakespeare community, my book has been very well received. It's gotten great reviews. I just won actually an International Book Award for narrative nonfiction, which I was very honored by. And so it seems like for folks who are sort of coming to this cold and seeing all the evidence that I lay out and reading this journey that I take with McCarthy, which I try to write about in a fun and engaging way, I think people are really enjoying the book. Within the Shakespearean community, I have to say that, mostly it's been met with silence and occasionally it's been met with, criticism, vitriol, you name it. I think there's this real emotional attachment that people have to Shakespeare, and in some ways a career attachment that people have to this certain version of Shakespeare that posits him as this kind of genius up on a hill that, can't be touched by mortal hands and sort of ignores all of these contradictions in Shakespeare's biography and all of these real questions that have emerged over the past couple hundred years that refuse to die. And it's really fascinating to me, as you said in the intro, one of the things I'm really fascinated at looking at is how knowledge gets created and what people do with knowledge that sort of challenges the status quo and the kind of received wisdom of how things are. And Dennis really represents a real threat to the kind of mainstream view of Shakespeare. And I think in some ways, unnecessarily, because I think it provides a really unique and interesting theory that still allows for Shakespeare's genius while also explaining, as I say, some of these mysteries. So I really hope that it does get taken seriously. And that's the reason I wrote the book.
Well, it is a fascinating read. The book is North by Shakespeare, A Rogue Scholar's Quest for the Truth Behind the Bard's Work. Michael Blanding, it's just been delightful to speak with you about the book. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Michael Blanding. Read an excerpt from North by Shakespeare by going to writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with James Rebanks about Pastoral Song, A Farmer's Journey, and William Dubuis tells us about Trail to Kanjaroba, Rediscovering Earth in an Age of Loss. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.